"He killed Carbone here," I repeated. "And then he jumped in his car and drove to Columbia and killed Brubaker there."
"Yes,"
Summer said. "But you figured he was already in a car," I said.
"Yes,"
she said again.
"I did."
"You figured he drove out on the track with Carbone, hit him in the head, arranged the scene, and then drove back here to the post. Your reasoning was pretty good. And where we found the crowbar kind of confirmed it."
"Thank you,"
she said. "And then we figured he parked his car and went about his business."
"Correct,"
she said. "But he can't have parked his car and gone about his business, because now we're saying he drove straight to Columbia, South Carolina instead to meet with Brubaker. 3-hour drive. He was in a hurry. Not much time to waste."
"Correct,"
she said again. "So he didn't park his car," I said. "He didn't even touch the brake. He drove straight out the main gate instead. There's no other way off the post. He drove straight out the main gate, Summer, immediately after he killed Carbone, somewhere around 9 or 10 o'clock.
"Check the gate log," she said. "There's a copy right there on the desk."
We checked the gate log together. Operation Just Cause in Panama had moved all domestic installations up one level on the DEFCON scale, and therefore all closed posts were recording entrances and exits in detail in bound ledgers that had pre-printed page numbers in the top right-hand corner. We had a good clear Xerox of the page for January 4th. I was confident it was genuine. I was confident it was complete. And I was confident it was accurate. The military police has numerous failings, but snafus with basic paperwork aren't any of them. Summer took the page from me and taped it to the wall next to the map. We stood side by side and looked at it. It was ruled into 6 columns. There were spaces for date, time in, time out, plate number, occupants, and reason.
"Traffic was light,"
Summer said. I said nothing. I was in no position to know whether 19 entries represented light traffic or not. I wasn't used to Bird, and it had been a long time since I'd pulled gate duty anywhere else. But it certainly seemed quiet compared to the multiple pages I'd seen for New Year's Eve.
"Mostly people reporting back for duty,"
Summer said. I nodded. 14 lines had entries in the time-in column, but no corresponding entries in the time-out column. That meant 14 people had come in and stayed in. Back to work, after time away from the post for the holidays. Or after time away from the post for other reasons. I was right there among them. 1490, 2302, Reacher, J, Major, RTB. January 4th, 1990, 2:11 in the evening, Major J. Reacher returning to base. From Paris, via Garber's old office in Rock Creek. My vehicle plate number was listed as pedestrian. My sergeant was there, coming in from her off-post address to work the night shift. She'd arrived at 9:30, driving something with North Carolina plates. 14 in. To stay in. Only 5 exits. 3 of them were routine food deliveries. Big trucks, probably. An army post gets through a lot of food. Lots of hungry mouths to feed. 3 trucks in a day seemed about right to me. Each of them was timed inward at some point during the early afternoon and then timed outward again a plausible hour or so later. The last time out was just before 3 o'clock. Then there was a 7-hour gap. The last but one recorded exit was Vassal and Coomer themselves, on their way out after their O Club dinner. They'd passed through the gate at 2201. They had previously been timed in at 1845. At that point, their Department of Defense plate number had been written down and their names and ranks had been entered. Their reason had been stated as courtesy visit. 5 exits, 4 down. 1 to go. The only other person to have left Fort Byrd on the 4th of January was logged as 1490-2211 Trifonoff S. Sergeant. There was a North Carolina passenger vehicle plate number written in the relevant space. There was no time in recorded. There was nothing in the reason column. Therefore, a sergeant called Trifonoff had been on post all day or all week, and then he had left at 11:10 in the evening. No reason had been recorded because there was no directive to inquire as to why a soldier was leaving. The assumption was that he was going out for a drink or a meal or for some other form of entertainment. Reason was a question the gate guards asked of people trying to get in, not trying to get out. We checked again, just to be absolutely sure. We came up with the same result. Apart from General Vassal and Colonel Coomer in their self-driven Mercury Grand Marquis, and then a sergeant called Trifonov and some other kind of car, nobody had passed through the gate in an outward direction, in a vehicle or on foot, at any time on the 4th of January, apart from three food trucks in the early part of the afternoon.
Okay, Summer said. Sergeant Trifonov, whoever he is, he's the one.
Has to be, I said. I called the main gate, got the same guy I'd spoken to before when I was checking on Vassal and Coomer earlier. I recognized his voice. I asked him to search forward through his log, starting from the page number immediately following the one we were looking at. Asked him to check exactly when a sergeant named Trifonov had returned to Bird. Told him it could be any time after about 4:30 in the morning on January 5th. There was a moment's delay. I could hear the guy turning the stiff parchment pages in the ledger. He was doing it slowly, paying close attention.
Sir, 5 o'clock in the morning precisely, the guy said. January 5th, 0500, Sergeant Trifonov returning to base.
I heard another page turn.
He left at 2211 the previous evening.
Remember anything about him?
He left about 10 minutes after those armored staffers you were asking me about before. He was in a hurry, as I recall. Didn't wait for the barrier to go all the way up. Squeezed right underneath it.
What kind of a car?
A Corvette, I think. Not a new one, but it looked pretty good.
Were you still on duty when he got back?
Yes, sir, I was.
Remember anything about that?
Nothing that stands out. I spoke to him, obviously. He has a foreign accent.
What was he wearing?
Civilian stuff. A leather jacket, I think. I assumed he'd been off duty.
Is he on the post now? I heard pages turning again. I imagined a finger tracing slowly down all the lines written after 0500 on the morning of the 5th.
We haven't logged him out again, sir, the guy said. Not as of right now, so he must be on post somewhere.
Okay, I said. Thanks, soldier. I hung up. Summer looked at me. He got back at 0500, I said, 3.5 hours after Brubaker's watch stopped.
3-hour drive, she said.
And he's here now.
Who is he?
I called post headquarters, asked the question. They told me who he was. I put the phone down and looked straight at Summer. He's Delta, I said. He was a defector from Bulgaria. They brought him in as an instructor. He knows stuff our guys don't. I got up from my desk and stepped over to the map on the wall, put my own fingers on the push pins. Little finger on Fort Byrd, index finger on Columbia. It was like I was validating a theory by touch alone. 150 miles, 3 hours and 12 minutes to get there, 3 hours and 37 minutes to get back. I did the math in my head. An average speed of 47 miles an hour going and 41 coming back. At night, on empty roads, in a Chevrolet Corvette. He could have done it with the parking brake on.
Should we have him picked up?
Okay, I said. Time to choose up sides. Was it a worse crime than shooting Brubaker in the head? Trifonov said nothing. Did you go up to Washington, D.C. and rape the president's 10-year-old granddaughters one after the other? No, he said. I'll give you a clue, I said. Where you're sitting, that would be about the only worse crime than shooting Brubaker in the head. He said nothing. Tell me.
It was a private thing, he said.
What kind of private thing? He didn't answer. Summer sighed and moved away from her map. She was starting to figure that wherever Trifonov had been, chances were it wasn't Columbia, South Carolina. She looked at me, eyebrows raised. Trifonov moved in his chair. His handcuffs clinked against the metal of the legs.
"What's going to happen to me?" he asked. "That depends on what you did," I said. "I got a letter," he said.
Getting mail isn't a crime.
From a friend of a friend.
Tell me about the letter.
There's a man in Sofia, he said.
He sat there, hunched forward, his wrists cuffed to the chair legs, and he told us the story of the letter. The way he framed it, he made it sound like he thought there was something uniquely Bulgarian about it. But there wasn't, really. It was a story that could have been told by any of us. There was a man in Sofia. He had a sister. The sister had been a minor gymnast and had defected on a college tour of Canada and had eventually settled in the United States. She'd gotten married to an American. She'd become a citizen. Her husband had turned out bad. The sister wrote about it to the brother back home. Long, unhappy letters. There were beatings and abuse and cruelty and isolation. The sister's life was hell. The communist censors had passed the letters because anything that made America look bad was okay with them. The brother in Sofia had a friend in town who knew his way around the city's dissident network. The friend had an address for Trifonov at Fort Byrd in North Carolina. Trifonov had been in touch with the dissident network before he skipped to Turkey. The friend had packaged up a letter from the man in Sofia and given it to a guy who bought machine parts in Austria. The machine parts guy had gone to Austria and mailed the letter. The letter made its way to Fort Byrd. Trifonov received it on January 2nd, early in the morning, at mail call. It had his name on it in big Cyrillic letters, and it was all covered in foreign stamps and Luftpost stickers. He had read the letter alone in his room. He knew what was expected of him. Time and distance and relationships compressed under the pressure of nationalist loyalty, so that it was like his own sister who was getting smacked around. The woman lived near a place called Cape Fear, which Trifonov thought was an appropriate name given her situation. He had gone to the company office and checked a map to find out where it was. His next available free time was the evening of January 4th. He made a plan and rehearsed a speech, which centered around the inadvisability of abusing Bulgarian women who had friends within driving distance. "Still got the letter?" I asked. He nodded.
"But you won't be able to read it, because it's written in Bulgarian."
"What were you wearing that night?"
"Plain clothes. I'm not stupid."
"What kind of plain clothes?"
"Leather jacket, blue jeans, shirt, American. They're all the plain clothes I've got."
"What did you do to the guy?" He shook his head. Wouldn't answer. "Okay," I said. "Let's all go to Cape Fear." We kept Trifonov cuffed and put him in the back of the MP Humvee. Summer drove. Cape Fear was on the Atlantic coast, south and east, maybe 100 miles. It was a tedious ride in a Humvee. It would have been different in a Corvette. Although I couldn't remember ever being in a Corvette. I'd never known anyone who owned one. And I'd never been to Cape Fear. It was one of the many places in America I had never visited. I'd seen the movie, though. Couldn't remember where, exactly. In a tent, somewhere hot, maybe. Black and white, with Gregory Peck having some kind of a major problem with Robert Mitchum. It was good enough entertainment, as I recalled, but fundamentally annoying. There was a lot of jeering from the audience. Robert Mitchum should have gone down early in the first reel. Watching civilians dither around just to spin out a story for 90 minutes had no real appeal for soldiers. It was full dark before we got anywhere near where we were going. We passed a sign near the outer part of Wilmington that billed the town as an historic and picturesque old port city, but we ignored it because Trifonov called through from the rear and told us to make a left through some kind of swamp. We drove out through the darkness into the middle of nowhere and made another left towards a place called Southport.
"Cape Fear's off Southport,"
Summer said.
"It's an island in the ocean. I think there's a bridge."
But we stopped well short of the coast. We didn't even get to Southport itself. Trifonov called through again as we passed a trailer park on our right. It was a large, flat, rectangular area of reclaimed land. It looked like someone had dredged part of the swamp to make a lake and then spread the fill over an area the size of a couple of football fields. The land was bordered by drainage ditches. There were power lines coming in on poles and maybe 100 trailers studded all over the rectangle. Our headlights showed that some of them were fancy double-wide affairs with add-ons and planted gardens and picket fences. Some of them were plain and battered. A couple had fallen off their blocks and were abandoned. We were maybe 10 miles inland, but the ocean storms had a long reach.
"Here," Trifonov said, "make a right."